In our last lesson, we began a three-chapter block of scripture and Numbers that seeks to make clear to all that the priesthood is central to Israel's relationship with Yahweh, and that the hierarchy of holiness that God has set up, first with the tribe of Levi being separated away from Israel for special holiness as his servants, second with the Levites themselves being divided up into two groups called the Levites and the priests, this was all unchangeable. It's a done deal. And what the Lord establishes, man doesn't change. And who the Lord decides is to be his priest, mankind cannot revise, certainly cannot abolish it. In the story that began in number 16, we find a general condition of upset, of unrest among the people of Israel. They're demoralized by the faithless and cowardly report from 10 of the 12 scouts and of Israel's leadership's subsequent decision to avoid the conquest of Canaan, which is their promised land. The people were disgruntled. They were emotionally unstable. They wanted change. And new leadership seemed like a good place to start. It was one thing for men to occasionally seek to remove one set of leaders and replace them with another. It's quite another for men to try to usurp God's will, as was the case in this rebellion. Now, Korah, a Levite who was dissatisfied with this line of Aaron, a family line who is from the tribe of Levi, but is a different clan than Korah's clan. Aaron's line is the only family line that can be appointed as the highly prestigious priests. And even though the entire tribe of Levi is separated from Israel for special holiness and service to God, the priests have been given an even greater degree of sanctification than all the other Levites, with the high priest, currently Aaron, being given the highest degree of holiness that is possible for any Hebrew, save for Moses. Now, Korah is jealous. He disputes this. He challenges Aaron's position. He wants it for himself. He wants the priesthood to be more evenly distributed among the Levite clans. See, this was typical tribal society behavior, where tribes and clans within tribes were in the never-ending cycle, vying among themselves for dominance, for status, for honor, for power. But the majority of the tribe of Levi, those who were not of Aaron's clan, were not the only ones who had a serious axe to grind. We find that the two clan leaders of the tribe of Reuben were challenging Moses for his job as the ultimate leader and authority over Israel. The founder of the tribe of Reuben, who was Reuben, had been dead for 300 years or so. So what number 16 is referring to when it speaks of Reuben are, of course, his descendants. Reuben, the firstborn son of Jacob, expected that he, so his future tribe, would have become the dominant tribe among the 12 tribes of Israel, as he also fully expected to have been awarded the leadership role over Israel by means of his birthright as the first son born to Jacob, and thus receiving the customary blessings of the firstborn from his father. But Jacob rejected Reuben. He refused to give him the firstborn blessing. And so the authority of the firstborn, thus humiliating him. And this would impact Reuben's family, eventually his tribe, in a very negative way from that moment forward. Instead, Jacob split the provisions of the firstborn blessing that should have gone to Reuben, giving the right of leadership of the nation of Israel to Judah and the right to inherit the largest portion of its wealth to Joseph. Reuben's descendants, even after all this time, had neither accepted this humiliation nor gotten over the loss of leadership status that they felt should have been theirs. And as a result, at this moment, we find two tribal leaders of Reuben, who are Dathan and Abiram, challenging Moses' position as the leader of Israel because they thought they ought to have the job. And along with Korah and Datan and Avram were 250 leaders of other Israelite tribes who also wished to remove Moses and Aaron from their God-established positions and to then take over the leadership of the nation of Israel for themselves. Well, Moses' solution was to let God handle it by means of a public demonstration. Each one of these rebel leaders was to put hot coals into a fire pan, also called a censer, and lay incense on top of it, and then take that smoking mixture to the tent of meeting. Then God would, in some undefined way, settle the matter as to who would be those privileged few, the priests, that would have access to the inner chambers of that sacred tent and would thus have control over Israel. So let's reread from Numbers 16. And we're going to start at verse 16 of Numbers 16, and we're going to go to the end of that chapter. If you have the complete Jewish Bible, it's page 168. 168. Numbers 16, starting at verse 16. Moses said to Korah, "You and your group, be there before Adonai tomorrow, you, they, and Aaron. Each of you take his fire pan and put incense in it. Every one of you bring before Adonai his fire pan, 250 fire pans, you too, and Aaron, each one of his fire pan. Each man took his fire pan, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the entrance to the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Korah assembled all the group who were against them at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Then the glory of Adonai appeared to the whole assembly. Adonai said to Moses and Aaron, 'Separate yourselves from this assembly. I'm going to destroy them right now.' And they fell on their faces and said, 'Oh God, God of the spirits of all humankind, if one person sins, are you going to be angry with the entire assembly?' And Adonai answered Moses, 'Tell the assembly to move away from the homes of Korah, Datan, and Avram.' And Moses got up, and he went to Datan and Avram, and the leaders of Israel followed him. And there he said to the assembly, 'Leave the tents of these wicked men. Don't touch anything that belongs to them, or you'll be swept away in all their sins.' So they moved away from all around the area where Korah and Datan and Avram lived. And then Datan and Avram came out and stood at the entrance to their tents with their wives and their sons and little ones. And Moses said, 'Here is how you will know that Adonai has sent me to do all these things and that I haven't done them on my own ambition. If these men die a natural death like other people, only sharing the fate common to all humanity, then Adonai has not sent me. But if Adonai does something new, if the ground opens up and swallows them with everything they own and they go down alive to Sheol, then you will understand that these men have had contempt for Adonai.' The moment he finished speaking, the ground under them split apart. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, all the people who had sided with Korah, everything they owned. So they and everything they owned went down alive to Sheol. The earth closed over them, and their existence in the community ceased. All Israel around them fled at their shriek, shouting, 'The earth might swallow us up too.' Then fire came out from Adonai and destroyed the 250 men who had offered the incense." Korah and the 250 leaders, and apparently some amount of the others, referred to as the whole community, those who sided with rebels, do as instructed, and they show up at the tent of meeting with their fire pans. Without doubt, this was not at the door that was the entrance to the sanctuary itself, but rather the gate into the tabernacle courtyard. This is where everybody gathered. Then the presence of God, the kavod, the glory, appeared before everyone, and the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and tells them to stand aside. He's gonna annihilate everyone who's involved with this thing. Now, it must be that only Aaron and Moses heard Jehovah speak, or certainly all these men would have turned pale and run for their lives. And as it happened in the past, the mediator of Israel falls on his face and he begs for mercy for these very men whose goal it was to do away with Moses and Aaron in a coup. And further, in verse 22, Moses asks, would you send your wrath on an entire community because one man sinned? Now, obviously, this one man is Korah, the instigator of this whole mess. At least in Moses' view, it was Korah who stirred up Dathan and Abiram, who then helped Korah stir up everybody else. But understand what's being discussed here. The topic is collective punishment, collective guilt, and collective punishment. Obviously, not each man is guilty in exactly the same way as all the others, nor is their level of participation universally equal among them all. Moses is both acknowledging and questioning this principle of collective punishment and whether God is serious about acting on that principle in this case. Now, this can all get a little bit confusing because the Bible keeps using the word community over and over, but it's actually each time referring to a somewhat different group of people. It's not unlike us pointing to a group and saying, these people, then pointing to a part of that group and saying, these people. The term is ha'edah in Hebrew, which is what is being translated here into the word community. It's a rather all-encompassing, a very flexible term that's used to refer to most any assembly of people, whether they're of a common race, or performing a common action, or agreeing on a common decision. So the community that showed up at the tent of meeting with the rebels was those who sided with the rebel leaders. And when the presence of the Lord appeared to the whole community in Hebrew, kol ha'edah, it was that everyone in the nation of Israel could see his presence. And when God told Moses to stand back from this community because he was going to destroy them, it was, of course, referring to the rebels and all of their backers. And when Moses asked God if he would destroy the kol edah, the whole community, because of one man's sin, this was referring to all Israel. And when we get to verse 26, and Moses tells the community to stand away from the tents of those wicked men, the reference to community in this case was to all those who didn't stand with the rebels. So you see kind of the problem here. And this is emphasized when Moses tells the innocent to disassociate themselves from the rebels, not to even touch any item that belongs to them, because they don't want to wind up being collateral damage. Now we find this principle of separation woven throughout the Bible, Old and New Testaments. Believers have to be separated from non-believers. The clean from the unclean. The sinners from the saved. Sheep from the goats. Lot had to be separated from the pagans of Sodom, or he was going to become collateral damage. The trick is to discern how and how much God's righteousness God's righteous are to be separated from the unrighteous. In other words, the essence of Yeshua's day took this principle to one extreme. And so they created their own separate colonies with stringent rules of membership. They even established their headquarters out in the wilderness far away from everyone else at a place down by the Dead Sea called Qumran. Messiah, by the way, didn't approve of this extreme kind of separation, and he said so. On the other hand, as believers, we are directly told in the Bible not to associate with murderers and thieves and those who do not belong to the Lord. We're to be in this world, just not of this world. Now notice that we find several things going on at once in this episode. First, it was that only Korah and the 250 leaders and their cohorts who showed up at the tent of meeting for this demonstration test involving the fire pans. Recall that Datan and Aviram had refused to come to this event when Moses summoned them. And since they were in essence saying that it should be they and not Moses running the show, it's easy to picture why they refused to respond when Moses sent for them. They were sending a message that they did not accept Moses' authority. Neither should anybody else. So if you can't bring Muhammad to the mountain, you bring the mountain to Muhammad. Verse 25 says, Moses rose, and he went to the tents of Datan and Aviram along with the elders of Israel, elders meaning the official representatives of the people of Israel, leaving from the eastern entrance and on into the tabernacle courtyard, and then venturing to the southern side of the encampment where Datan and Aviram's tribe camped. It's important to remember that the tribe of Levi camped adjacent to the tribe of Reuben, so they formed kind of a neighborhood together. And when Moses showed up at the tents of Datan and Aviram, they came out to confront him. And Moses pronounces judgment upon them. And he says, if you live to a normal lifespan, and then you die, like any man does, that thereby indicates that Moses was acting on his own accord, and it was not Yahweh who was ordering him to do all of this. In other words, if God doesn't do something spectacular to harm them, then indeed this has been incorrect all along. Moses was not the legitimate leader of Israel. On the other hand, Moses says, if the ground opens up and swallows you, you're wrong. Death is your divine punishment. Well, no sooner had Moses finished speaking the last syllable did the ground open beneath the tents of Datan and Aviram and those surrounding them who sided with them, and they all vanished into this deep crevasse. They perished. And the dead included the families of Korah, all those among his clan who sided with him. It's made clear. Women, children, everybody. Even their tents, all of their material possessions fell into this enormous split in the earth. In other words, every last vestige of these rebels' lives, every evidence that they had ever existed, was wiped out at the hand of God in one moment of his wrath. And all the Israelites who saw what happened, presumably all the innocent ones, fled in panic for fear they'd fall into this gaping hole. The last verse of this chapter then changes location. We're taken back from the south side of the encampment where Moses had walked to the east side, and now we're back to the tent of meeting. And there, Korah and his 250 men who had showed up with their unauthorized firepans to challenge God's established priestly hierarchy, men who had no business because they didn't have sufficient status to even come near to God, were burned alive by fire coming from God's own presence. If this isn't a good picture of hell, the lake of fire, and the ultimate punishment of the unrighteous, I don't know what is. The rebels and their families and everything they owned were purged from Israel because they had become unclean and unworthy in God's sight. Recall that a few years earlier, some other men had offered strange fire to God, and they suffered the same fate. Nadav and Abihu, sons of the high priest Aaron. These rebellious men just destroyed did not have the right to be doing what they were doing. See, the problem for Nadav and Abihu was they offered coals from something other than the altar of burnt offering, which was the only allowable place for coals to come from. So the sin against God perpetrated by Korah and Datan and Aviram and of these 250 men was even worse than what Nadav and Abihu had done. In the case of Nadav and Abihu, only they suffered the divine wrath, for they acted only on their own behalf. In the case of Korah, Datan, and Aviram, and their entire immediate families, as well as anyone who agreed with them, they were all destroyed. Pretty serious stuff. Next, it says that all the rebels went down to Sheol. Now, Sheol was the place of the dead, the grave. It was seen as a place that lay below the surface of the ground. Was Sheol contemplated in that era in the same way that we currently do, as a place where Satan and his demon henchmen dwell? As hell or Hades, a place of fire and eternal torment for lost souls? No, it wasn't. In fact, they weren't at all clear what Sheol was, other than it was the grave. And maybe there was some kind of afterlife that existed. They weren't clear what happened to the physical body after death, other than normal decomposition. They weren't clear what happened to the breath of existence that we usually call a soul when they died. We're going to find throughout the Torah that the Israelites were very worried about what happened to them after death, because Sheol was seen as everybody's destiny, not just the wicked. But one of the worst things that could happen once in Sheol, the big worry was that worms would eat up one's body. And often, that is what was thought to be a divine punishment for those who died in an unrighteous state. Why this inordinate concern about what happened to their bodies after they were dead? First, they had no concept of heaven or going to live with God. Remember, they thought as the Egyptians thought. And Egyptians spent their entire lives getting ready for their death. Their afterlife was predicated on a preservation of the physical body. That's why they invented embalming. And they had protected places for their corpses to remain after they died. So although Israel didn't practice the death cult or body preservation of the Egyptians per se, they did have in their minds this dilemma of just what did happen to them after death, what to do about it, how to prepare for it. And the primary point of the punishment that is expressed in this story, that you know, they fell into the crevasse and down to Sheol, was that these people died at God's hand. Or to sharpen the point a little bit, they died prematurely because of a consequence of their decisions and their behavior. And dying before one's normal lifespan was over was seen as a terrible thing, and it was greatly feared. Now, last week I told you that one of the main lessons that we ought to take from this is that redemption can not only be rejected in the first place, it can be given back at the will of the one who received it. Just as Korah and Dathan and Abiram and hundreds, if not thousands, of their followers had determined to choose their old lives back in Egypt rather than remain in their redemption from Egypt that they had already received from God, so it is with we modern-day believers. Put the emphasis on choose. Because those rebels chose to go with Israel when they left Egypt. They were certainly not forced to go. And these same rebels chose to make for themselves new leaders who would take them back to Egypt. They chose to give up their redemption. It works in the same way for us. Nobody can take our redemption away from us. Nobody. There's no place we can travel to where our redemption becomes invalid. But did we not choose to accept our redemption? We can also choose to let go of it. And tragically, some countless number of people has chosen, and many more will choose, to go back to Egypt. But even more tragically is what happens to us when we do refuse or we give back our redemption, and it's demonstrated in full living color for us here in number 16. The consequence is that we are utterly and completely destroyed. There's no hope. There's no future. All that we worked a lifetime to build and acquire becomes as nothing. And perhaps worse is that particular as the male leaders of our families and our congregations, we have the ability to lead others away from their redemption. We can influence the decision of others. And they can suffer the same fate we will because of our own rebellion. And man, that's a sobering thought. Listen to John 15, starting in verse 1. I am the real vine, and the Father is the gardener. Every branch which is part of me, but fails to bear fruit, he will cut off. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, so that you will bear more fruit. Right now, because of the word which I have spoken to you, you are pruned. Now stay united with me, as I will with you. For just as the branch can't put forth fruit by itself apart from the vine, you can't bear fruit apart from me. I am the vine, you're the branches. Those who stay united with me, and I with them, are the ones who will bear much fruit, because apart from me, you can't do a thing. Unless a person remains united with me, then he's thrown away like a branch, and he dries up, and these branches are gathered up and thrown into the fire, where they are burned up. Every branch, every believer that is part of Christ but fails to bear fruit is cut off. And what happens to those cut off branches that were at one time united with Messiah? They're thrown away. They dry up and they're thrown into a fire where they're burned up. It's pretty clear. Those are the words. But let me also show you another foundational God principle that's demonstrated here. And it's this. Not everyone is permitted to approach God. In fact, only the redeemed can come near to the Lord. But even more, only the redeemed that are declared holy on some level can come near the Lord. On so many occasions, I've referenced Paul, John, and others in the New Testament who allude to believers as being priests for the Lord. And I think that this is both figurative and literal to a degree. We find here in Numbers that Jehovah God declares that only priests can come near to his presence. And even then, that is to a degree, and it's based on their status. Regular priests can come near to him, but only so near. It's only the high priest that's allowed to come closest to his glory. But even that's limited to one day in a year, Yom Kippur. Those who do attempt to approach God, but who are not deemed by God to be priests, are destroyed, as were Korah and the rest of the bunch. Why? Because they weren't authorized for such nearness to his presence. One of the many things that salvation accomplishes is to give us authorized access to God. God, by means of our belief and trust in Yeshua, Jesus our Messiah, authorizes us to come into a place that no others are allowed, under any circumstance, near to him. Notice the dynamic in the hierarchy that's set up in Israel. Moses is the sole mediator. He stands alone and above. There is no access to God without going through Moses, the mediator. Those who tried to replace that mediator or were determined to go around God's appointed mediator were just rejected. They were destroyed with no further hope of reinstatement. Our only possible access to God is by Yeshua, our mediator. We have to come to Yeshua before we can come near to God. No, I'm not forgetting Yeshua is God, but that's another inscrutable matter. It was Moses who anointed the original priests in God's name as the mediator. It is Christ that has to anoint us with the Holy Spirit, which acts as our official authorization to come near to God. But even then, there is a limitation as to just how near to God we're allowed in our present condition. Because even though He's given us new and clean spirits, these bodies, they're still made of corrupt material. Our minds still have evil inclinations. Therefore, we are told of a time when we will get new bodies made of uncorrupted material and new minds that we're told will not remember the former days. Then we'll be able to come even nearer to the Father. Now, I can't tell you if the writers of the New Testament simply saw a direct correlation between the ability of Levite priests to come near to God and then with the advent of Jesus, this new ability for common people, Hebrew or Gentile, to come near to God by means of Christ. And therefore, from this understanding, they drew an analogy that we disciples of Yeshua are like priests in that regard. Or it may be that God actually and literally views us as His new and transformed priesthood. All that's open to discussion. But what I can tell you is that the pattern of how one is permitted to come near to the Lord was set up a long time ago. And the details of that pattern are explained here in the Torah. Let's read a little bit further. We're going to read the first 15 verses of Numbers chapter 17, starting on page 168, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Numbers 17, starting at verse 1, we're going to go through verse 15. Adonai said to Moshe, "Tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron the Kohen, the priest, to remove the fire pans from the fire and scatter the smoldering coals at a distance, because they have become holy. Also, the fire pans of these men whose sin cost them their lives have become holy, because they were offered before Adonai. Therefore, have them hammered into plates to cover the altar. This will be a sign." Eleazar the priest took the brass fire pans which the men had been burned to death, had offered, and they hammered them into a covering for the altar to remind the people of Israel that any ordinary person not descended from Aaron is not to approach and burn incense before Adonai if he wants to avoid the fate of Korah and his group, as Adonai had said to him through Moses. But the very next day, the whole community of the people of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. "You've killed Adonai's people." However, as the community was assembling against Moses and Aaron, they looked in the direction of the tent of meeting. They saw a cloud over it, and the glory of Adonai appeared. Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and Adonai said to Moses, "Get away from this assembly. I'm going to destroy them at once." But they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your fire pan, put fire from the altar in it, lay incense on it, and hurry with it to the assembly to make atonement for them, because anger has gone out from Adonai, and the plague has begun already." Aaron took it, as Moses had said, and he ran into the middle of the assembly. And there the plague had already begun among the people, but he added the incense and made atonement for the people. He stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Those dying from the plague numbered 14,700, besides those who died in the Korah incident. Aaron turned to Moses at the entrance to the tent of meeting, and the plague was stopped. Under the pile of these charred human remains lay more than 200 copper fire pans. that belonged to those rebels who presumed to disregard God's requirement that only priests were allowed to offer incense to him. But we have a problem. Just as being removed from the sanctuary grounds can defile holy items, common things that weren't intended for sacred purposes can contract holiness by being offered to God. It's very much like the principles of clean and unclean, whereby uncleanness can be transmitted from one thing or person to another like a contagious virus. So the Lord asks, or orders rather, Moses to instruct Eleazar the priest to perform the rather unpleasant task of sifting through all of those charred bodies and removing those melted fire pans that had become holy by means of their being offered to God. Notice in verse 2 that the coals used in those rebels' fire pans had to be removed from the area. The area meaning the courtyard, tabernacle courtyard. This is because the coals weren't taken from the great altar of burnt offering. These were common coals that each of these rebels had brought with them from their own campfires in front of their own tents. Therefore, these coals had to be taken away from the holy area and disposed of. But the fire pans that had contracted a measure of holiness that they weren't authorized to have, they had to be dealt with in another way. The solution was to hammer them into a lid for the fire basket of the altar. And this served two purposes. It served the practical purpose of keeping the banked coals of the altar hot overnight. And it served as a reminder to the people of what happens when an unauthorized person encroaches on the sacred area. So we see another pattern emerge. God sets up ordinances and regulations as reminders to his people to obey him. Remember, why were people to wear tzitzit? They were the direct result of the incident of the man who gathered sticks for a fire on Shabbat. And he paid the ultimate price, the loss of both his physical and his spiritual life. That man had failed to observe one of God's commandments, and the Lord commanded then tzitzit as a visual aid to help others avoid the same fate. And as every Israelite would regularly have to come to the tabernacle with their offering, their sacrifices, they would see the lid on the altar made of the fire pans of all those rebels who had been burned up for thinking so little of God's priesthood, and they would remember what happened. It would remind the people of what happens when we mere humans presume to declare who or what is holy outside of what God declares is holy. But wouldn't you just know it? Even with the stench of those smoldering bodies still lingering in the air, much of the community of Israel still didn't get it. So they set up a protest rally against Moses and Aaron. I mean, this would absolutely be hilarious if it wasn't so dangerously and irreverently foolhardy. They say to Moses and Aaron, it's you that brought death upon the people of Israel. Amazing. But as I have attempted to demonstrate on numerous occasions, we have to grasp that this Israelite people was at this time more Egyptian in their thinking than Hebrew. All the Middle East believed in sorcerers and priests whose job was less a matter of serving their gods and figuring out, rather than trying to figure out how to manipulate those gods for their own purposes. It was the same in Egypt, where it was believed that a good priest or a good magician, well, he could cause one god or another to do his bidding. And that thought formed a lot of the basis for Hebrew thinking about God in that era. So even though the people well knew that Moses and Aaron hadn't set fire to those 250 leading men at the gate of the tabernacle, nor had they themselves somehow caused this great split in the earth, everybody to fall into it. They did believe that Moses and Aaron had manipulated God to do it for them. You know, kind of like hiring a heavenly hitman. And sadly, another lesson was necessary. Once more the people rebelled, and once more the presence of God appears and announces his intention to wipe out this large group of protesters. Was God's plan to annihilate all Israel? No, just this rather large contingent of those who felt that it had been unjust of Jehovah to destroy those 250 at the tabernacle, and also those hundreds, maybe thousands, who fell into that great crevasse in the earth. And once more Moses and Aaron fell on their faces. They prayed. They pled with God not to destroy what likely amounted to scores of thousands of people. And once again, God tells Moses and Aaron, separate yourselves from these people because there's going to be divine retribution. Why is it that God keeps telling Moses and Aaron to separate themselves from this community that he plans on punishing? Will God wipe away the good people right along with the evil ones? Answer, absolutely. I hope that shocks you and bothers you a little bit. We have example after example of this in the Word. The way it works is this. The righteous will be affected by the same outpouring of wrath as the wicked if they're not separated from the wicked. In Genesis, as messed up in his thinking as Lot had become, he was still considered sufficiently righteous as to not be counted among the wicked of Sodom. Yet Lot literally had to be dragged out of the city by two angels, because if he hadn't been, he would have been destroyed when that city was destroyed by fire from heaven. Lot's wife did not separate herself sufficiently from the city. Even though she was given that opportunity, she stopped to look back and yearn for what she had left behind, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. When the Lord determined to destroy the earth in a great flood, he first instructed Noah to build an ark to save his family. The flood was completely indiscriminate. It killed everybody. Only those who chose to obey God and were given the opportunity to separate themselves from the wicked escaped. Back in Egypt, God went throughout Egypt and killed all the firstborn of every man and every animal. It didn't matter whether that firstborn was Hebrew, Egyptian, Syrian, Arabian, whatever. It didn't matter whether this was a good man or an evil man. If you were a firstborn, you were marked for death. Except God provided a means for those who trusted him to separate themselves from this national disaster. But they had to paint the blood of a lamb on their doorposts of their homes. And if they did, then that blood served as a protective barrier, a dividing line between they and everybody else. So they were separated and passed over. As believers, when we stay attached to the wicked ways and wicked people of this world, we put ourselves at serious risk of being collateral damage when God judges them, or perhaps even the whole world. I want to be clear. By attached, I mean identified with. That is, that we identify with their ways and their thinking. We agree with it. Can you be a believer and still agree with so much of the ways of the world? Oh, you bet you can. And we see it every day. But what the Lord is explaining here is not that we're supposed to go off and create exclusive Christian communities or messianic communities apart from all other communities. It's that any time and every time we must demonstrate our actions, whether we stand with the world or we stand with the Word, we must be willing to separate ourselves or risk the divine consequences. And in case you haven't noticed, it's becoming harder and harder to do. The more obedient we are, the more we get labeled as fanatics, nutballs, and fundamentalists. We're jeered at. We're told we're backward. We're ignorant. But lately, we're starting to be labeled as dangerous. Dangerous to world peace, because we're not tolerant enough. If we speak against abortion and homosexuality, now we're haters. We're full of hate. If we don't agree with Israel giving up their inheritance to the Palestinians, then we're Zionist wackos, and we're impeding world peace. Will you respond when God calls for you to be separate? That's the question. Or will you remain identified with all the familiar and the comfortable ways of the majority? I implore you to back away from any identification with what God calls wicked. Because at any moment, judgment can fall. And any one of us can be an innocent bystander. Not that innocent. Next week, we're going to watch as judgment falls on the community of those who identified with Korah and Dathan and Abiram and felt sympathy for them because of what they did.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.